A new administration, but perhaps some of the same old lingering problems. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. It's Friday. Glad to have you along. Thanks for downloading and tapping play. Here for our usual weekly discussion about some of the recent political happenings are Aisha Du with the organization Higher Heights and Clark Reamer, a staff member at the North Carolina General Assembly. Good to see you both.
Good to see you. Good to be here.
Great to be here. Happy Friday. We made it through another week.
This conversation was recorded Friday morning via Zoom. Joe Biden was sworn in as America's 46th president on Wednesday, Kamala Harris as the nation's 49th vice president, the first woman, the first person of color. How did you consume the moment Wednesday afternoon, and what struck you most? Aisha?
Well, thanks for letting me have this one first. It was a great day. It was wonderful. I was actually a little emotional to see the first Black woman, Asian woman, first woman, period, to hold the office of vice president was absolutely wonderful. And I think that she and Joe Biden are just clearly ready to lead day one. And together they'll make a tremendous team. It was also really wonderful that there were no violent actions. You know, of course, I think we all were biting our nails up until the day of after what happened with the insurrection. The last time we gathered, we talked about the insurrection. So, you know, with the threats of people going to different spaces, going to all 50 states and going to the Capitol buildings there. I think what only one person showed up in Raleigh for the protest. So it was good to see a safe, beautiful transition of power and to see the bipartisanship that we're used to for this type of thing. It was so good to see our democracy play out the way that it should.
You know, it was delightfully uneventful, which was a great thing. It's always wonderful to see our peaceful transition of power in this country. It's something we've taken for granted and perhaps got a rude shock that we shouldn't always take it for granted a couple weeks ago.
Where did you view this, and how did you view it as a Republican watching the end of what I think most everyone can agree has been a divisive 4 years?
Yeah, I was actually had Zoom meeting calls from 10 till 3, which was not intentional to the inauguration, but just was the way my schedule worked out that day. So I had the inauguration kind of on in the background in my office. But I won't say it had my full attention. Had some work to do, but I was here. I did watch a lot of the coverage on Twitter, both during and after. And it was very moving, especially to see some of my Republican female friends and people of color that just were very moved by the sight of the vice president being sworn in, Kamala Harris, and seeing that ceiling broken. So, you know, it was a great day. What I really hope is that we will see action on the call for unity that President Biden had in his inaugural address. Unfortunately, the first 48 hours have been fairly partisan in tone and tenor, so we'll see how that develops long term.
So I was here. I was here at my home, and I was with my mom, and we had a watch party with Higher Heights in Essence. We streamed it and had conversation. I was not publicly a part of the public facing conversation. So I was able to just watch it and enjoy the moment. And this moment is still really, really, it was a meaningful moment, and it was so different from all of the others. I mean, I would have been in D.C., so we would have been getting ready for a ball or whatever by the evening and still there through potentially the weekend with different types of activities. So this was very different in the sense that there wasn't a luncheon and they just got to work. And it was meaningful and beautiful and wonderful to see them.
I want to move on to the party factions that I mentioned off the top. But before we do that, Clark, I want to double back to something that you said. What was the most political thing or the most overtly political thing that you saw that perhaps didn't sit well with you with the backdrop of these calls for unity? What are you talking about there?
One of the things that stuck out to me the most that kind of running counter to the rhetoric in the inauguration is the canceling of the Keystone XL by Fiat immediately in the administration. You're talking about something that is strongly supported by our, you know, closest neighbor and friend, the Canadian government. You know, they asked the Biden administration not to do it. The one poll I've seen out says that 51% of America supports and disagrees with the canceling, and it was done very quickly. And you wonder about the process that went into making that decision and the consultations that were done to make a fairly divisive decision. But it's certainly one that will appeal to the environmental faction of President Biden's base and help fulfill his campaign, you know, his campaign debt to them. And you wonder if that's not the motivation rather than unifying.
Well, I have to say, I don't think that it's been hyper-partisan. I did, of course, notice that that was one of the initial actions that was taken. And, you know, I'll say this. It just goes back to what I'm going to continue to say to a certain extent. And all I can say is that we saved democracy so we can go back to having a conversation. We were going to a point where everything was so hyper-polarized. That now, welcome back to the conversation. And we know how legislation works, and we know how the process works, in the sense that this is not the final part of the conversation, but this is where we are right now.
And if you look at the total numbers, we had, I believe Biden had 17 executive orders in the first 24 hours. The most we've seen previously was 8 by President Obama. President Trump only had 4. So there was a rash of executive action that happened very quickly. I'll also be interested to see the DACA executive order by Trump was criticized widely and actually overturned by the courts based on the process followed and whether there was adequate consultation inside the administration. So it'll be interesting to see how that court precedent stands up to that many executive orders this quickly in a new administration.
Well, it's an unprecedented time. I mean, this is a pandemic. We haven't had an insurrection at the White House since 1812. So this is a very different time. So, you know, time will tell and we'll see what happens. Everything and almost anything can probably go to court. I have a suspicion that they have crossed their T's with this process and that it will stand. But time will tell.
All right. Let's move on. The most divisive president ever is gone. Now, Democrats just barely have unified control over the federal government. We're going to skip the unity for a moment and focus on the factions within each party. Earlier this week on the WUNC Politics podcast, conservative voices weighed in on where Republicans go in the wake of a Trump presidency. Remember, a record 81% of Republicans here cast ballots. That was in November. Michael Whatley, chairman of the state Republican Party, says that sustaining Trump enthusiasm in the next few years is key.
What we need to make sure is that as we go into 2022 and even 2024, that we're going to be able to keep those Trump voters and turn them into reliable Republican voters. And the way that we're going to be able to do that is by having an America First agenda that is focused on a populist approach and is going to be focused on making sure that we're lifting up all Americans.
Clark, without embracing conspiracy theories, QAnon, other dangerous fringe messages, is that achievable?
Yes, I think it is achievable. I think there are sets of policies that have broad appeal. I think actually what you saw in this election in many ways is that Trump's policies were in many cases more popular than Trump himself was. I think the Republican Party is going to carry forward a message of continuing to put America first, especially through our trade policy. I think that's going to be a big issue continuing forward. I think that's one of the real successes President Trump had, despite all his divisiveness, is renegotiating the NAFTA agreement. And then again, to go back to the Keystone XL thing, where you see something that's really going to hurt American workers, like canceling a major pipeline that's going to, along with, there's been discussions in the Biden administration about increasing the gas tax. There's going to be a carbon tax discussion. When you get into these really bread and butter economic issues that especially affect the heartland, I think that's where the Republican Party is going to have a major pushback and going to really fight for those kitchen table issues that affect working families.
Aisha, this is the party of Trump at the moment. I don't think anyone is going to honestly disagree with that. How long is this going to be the party of Trump?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, Colin Powell left, right? There's definitely been a shift, especially after the insurrection. There's been a shift from the day that Donald Trump won. And I think that those who are middle of the road and moderate don't want to be a part of something that is so divisive, so polarizing, and also really uplifts and supports racism, right? So, I mean, we as an overall country are at a pivotal, critical crossroads where we have to decide who we are. And I don't think that that's any different for and that then trickles down to the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. So are we really going to be a place that unifies and unity is a great word, but unity also comes with true understanding, justice and relationship. So now it's time for us to build a relationship with the people. And so whichever party does that the best, and I think and hope it will be the Democratic Party, will be the party that moves forward. And I think it's going to be interesting to see, Donald Trump Patriot Party takes on, if that's a real thing. It'll be interesting to see what it looks like for us in North Carolina with potentially having Laura Trump on the ballot. This is not history that can yet be written down in stone at all. We're definitely projecting and we're definitely waiting to see what people are going to do.
And one thing I'd note is that we've never really seen, especially in modern times, a political party defined by a former president. Even the most influential, I would argue, on his party going forward was President Clinton, with Senator Hillary being in office and her political career and her running for president. But even then, you didn't see, you know, Clintonism being the major factor going forward, you know, even in opposition to President Bush when he was in office. So certainly President Trump is likely to try and have an increased voice over what, you know, many presidents kind of stand back versus what he will likely do. But I rarely have seen a party defined by an out-of-office leader.
Do you disagree that that's where we're headed? I agree with you, it's unprecedented, but it would seem as though Trump is going to wield a significant amount of power over Republicans here in the next two or three election cycles.
It's possible. I'm somewhat of a skeptic of that concept. You know, you've already seen, I think, Leader McConnell trying to draw some fairly bright distinctions between the Republican Senate majority and President Trump. And I think as he moves off the stage, you're going to see more and more of that effort in the party.
Is the best way for the Republican Party to move on from President Trump a conviction in the Senate? Does that allow for Republicans to have effectively a clean break and perhaps limit his influence moving forward?
My worry about a conviction in the Senate and continuing the impeachment effort is that it really drags this divisiveness forward. It continues the divide that we have in this country, and that it derails any ability to have bipartisan progress in the Senate in the first 100 days and likely the first session of this Congress. You know, we generally see that Congress has about 2 years to, or a year really, to govern before they're focused on the next election, especially on the House side. So my worry on an impeachment effort as it continues is that it will really just take all the focus away from policy and make it, again, sheer personality and partisan politics.
You know, I think that because we are in the middle of a pandemic and because we have seen unprecedented racism rise to the surface over the last 4 years and culminate with an insurrection at the Capitol to stop the actual democratic process, this is really not about personality. This is about how we move forward effectively as a country. So we had what was radical reconstruction, and there were more black people elected to the state legislature or elected period across the country, but in North Carolina in particular, right? And then all of a sudden we came up with the society reacted and came up with ways to hold people back. And so this is not about a personality. This is about how we move forward holistically and holding people accountable so that it's not okay to do that again. It's not okay to lead people to the Capitol and to tell them to stop the democratic process. It's not okay to encourage people who leave nooses across the Capitol, defecate in front of people's offices, and essentially try to hurt and kill them. It's not okay to be in a space where you actually remove panic buttons from Representative Ayanna Pressley's office and others. So this is really beyond personality at this point. So it'll be interesting to see how things move forward, but I do not think that continuing forth with the impeachment process will be about personality. It will be about how we holistically truly heal and move forward with a sense of unity. And if one has to live in fear, it's very hard to come together in unity.
Republicans, understandably, are quick to point out that there has been some criminal justice reform in recent years. They point out that President Trump received a larger share of the African-American and the Latino vote in 2020 than he did in 2016. And Republicans here in North Carolina also point to Mark Robinson, Lieutenant Governor. He's now, I believe, the highest ranking African-American official in the history of North Carolina politics. So one of the things I'm wondering about is what more, if anything, would you like to see Republicans do to cultivate inroads and improve, even acknowledging those things, improve relations with Black and Brown voting factions?
Sure. I think one thing, or the biggest thing the Republican Party needs to do is really spend more time being involved in minority communities. I think when the Republican Party parachutes in with a message, and we have done, especially in North Carolina, some great policy on criminal justice reform, on raise the age, on banning the box, things that really do have bread and butter impact in minority communities and people across the state. That's a great message. But when you come in only on election day and you don't have a relationship and community with those people, it comes off as oftentimes uncredible or self-serving. So I think you need continual engagement and outreach from the Republican Party to those communities. I think you're starting to see more of that. I think it's an effort that's going to continue, and I'm very excited about.
I think that's great. I mean, overall, we don't need to have transactional relationships with our community, no matter what party we are. And I think that, you know, if we're going to move forward as a country, we have to continue the conversation. And that doesn't happen 2 days before early voting and right upon election day. One of the things that I think that's happened during COVID is that we started digital communications earlier. Not everyone, but many started their mail programs earlier. People were really forced to get on the phones and text. And of course, we know that that Clark, I think more of your folks are actually on the doors. But the reality of it is that the conversation started earlier in a lot of situations, and that's honestly what we all need. Let's continue the conversation and let's start it early, and let's talk to people about what they want and need.
And on the left, we have Democrats who, despite running against one of the most unpopular presidents ever, actually lost seats in the U.S. House. They had to win the two runoffs in Georgia to snag that 50-50 Senate. Tiebreaker goes to VP Harris. Some big policy questions loom. True immigration reform? A Green New Deal? The Dems and the far left are divided. Aisha, let's start with you on this one. I'm wondering, what policy issues do you think are the most dangerous potential pitfalls for Democrats?
I don't think there are any, because of course I'm always going to go back to the big tent party where there's space for everyone to have a conversation, which means we're not divided. We're in the big tent continuing the conversation. But what I will say is that I think that when you look at Georgia in particular, we did indeed lose seats. And a part of what happened in Georgia is that they spent more time talking to voters. So when you talk about comprehensive justice reform and community safety, you know, you had what? 70,000, I think, black men who turned out in the general election who hadn't turned out even starting with federal elections in 2008 who were registered to vote. So one of my colleagues who specifically did work with black males talked about what comprehensive public safety looks like to the people that they're talking to. And so sometimes it means that they definitely need to be protected. And at other times, it also means that they need to have a different relationship with law enforcement in their community, where law enforcement really supports and connects with the community. So I think that we have an opportunity to win. And I think that some of the progressive ideas can also still work if there's time for a conversation around what that looks like.
Clark, I'll come to you in just a minute. Aisha, let me hammer down a little bit, at least on immigration reform, because as I think about the landscape of the U.S. Senate, it is 50-50. Joe Manchin is an obvious example, perhaps the most obvious example, of a moderate Democrat, somebody from a rural state that does not have a lot of folks that fall under the umbrella of this conversation. You don't think immigration and significant immigration reform is a potential pitfall for Democrats here in the next few years?
I think that we still have to keep telling the story and having the conversation, because no one really thought it was a great idea within this big tent that children were being separated from their parents and left alone at the border, right? The idea that you would take a parent and move them back into a dangerous situation, so therefore they separate them from their child and perhaps not even be reconnected with their families. I think that the stark immigration policies of this last presidency, of this last administration, were really so stark. We just have to tell the story in a way that makes sense. So I do think that immigration reform has to be and will be on the table, and we have to be clear about what that is.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head with the Manchin question.
If you'll allow me to go back to the dynamic that we had when we last had unified Republican control with Speaker Ryan, and you had the Freedom Caucus pulling House legislation further right, and then a Senate that would be more skeptical of those policies, I think you're going to see a similar thing here. And again, the political incentives are kind of aligned, where you may see AOC and her bloc and the left or progressive left push Pelosi and legislation she is going to forward to the Senate further left than she might like in order to win those votes, because they probably have enough votes in a close House of Representatives to demand some concessions. And then you've got Senator Manchin and a few other red state Democratic senators that are going to have a lot of trouble with some of those issues and being able to be on the ballot next time. I think tax increases are going to be are always a hard vote for any politician. And then looking at West Virginia, major climate policy is going to be a pitfall in coal country, and any major steps on gun control are also going to be some real divides on those issues.
Aisha Dhu is the political director with Higher Heights. Clark Riemer is the chief of staff to State House Representative Jason Sain. Enjoy your weekends.
Thank you.
We review some of the political happenings each Friday here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. We also invade your feeds on Tuesdays. This past Tuesday, as you heard us allude to, those words from Michael Whatley, the chair of the North Carolina State Republican Party. This past Tuesday, we did a collection of Republican voices about where conservatives go in the wake of a Trump presidency. Be sure to check out that podcast from just a few days ago. And as you're refreshing your podcast feed for the weekend, make sure that Tested and Embodied are part of your plan. Thanks as always. Glad to have you along. For Clark and Aisha, my name is Jeff. We'll talk to you again next week. Politics?
Politics.
Podcast.
Politics.
Politics Podcast. Who am I?
Dada to be.